This is the 2010 West Coast School of the Prophets. The theme for the weekend is the prophecy of Ezekiel 38. Our study leader is Brother Roger Lewis of New Zealand. This is sessions 9 and 10. Is Russia really mentioned in Ezekiel 38 and identifying Magog, Rosh, Meshech, and Tubal? Brother Roger.
So this session then finally brings us into Ezekiel 38, which is sort of good to get there at some stage, isn't it? We've obviously touched on the idea of Gog as an entity and found that Gog had an historical context himself, in as much as there was a person that bore this this precise name. So now we come to the puzzle of the passage where there's been some debate, not only in the breadth of scholarship, but even within the Brotherhood itself, as to what Ezekiel 38 and verse 2 means or doesn't mean when it says, "Son of man, set thy face against Gog of the land of the Magog, the chief prince of Meshech and Tubal, and prophesy against him." And of course, we've got this debate about whether it should be the chief prince of Meshech and Tubal or whether it should be the prince of Rosh, Meshech, and Tubal. Now, what I would like to do is to spend just a little bit of time covering this question. So the question for this session then is Russia really mentioned in Ezekiel 38, finalising the question of how exactly Rosh should be translated? Because no doubt the word Rosh is there. The question is, should it be taken as a proper name or should it be taken in its adjectival form, meaning that it means chief or head or some other thing. Perhaps because there's been quite a bit of debate on this, even within the Brotherhood, I thought it would be useful to be thorough enough to send you away convinced that we believe that the application of the word Rosh in Ezekiel 38 verse 2 ought to be applied as a proper name in its noun form, and that it does relate to a power or an entity. So let me just walk you through what the background is here. The reason why our English version has what it has is because basically of the Latin Vulgate. Let me just find my notes, which I disappeared somewhere. If we go back to the writing of the Latin Vulgate, anyone know who wrote the Latin Vulgate? It was Jerome, that's correct. And when he came to write the Vulgate, he had a dilemma as to what he would do with the word Rosh in Ezekiel 38. And so he followed another man, actually. He followed a previous translator called Aquila, and he had translated Rosh as an adjective rather than a noun. So by turning it into an adjective, we ended up with the word chief. Prince rather than the word Rosh. Actually, I've still got that the wrong way around. It would be the chief prince. So the word Rosh here is the word chief in the English version. And Aquila decided to translate it as an adjective and made it chief rather than a name. And Jerome decided to follow when he came to his translation of the Latin Vulgate from the Hebrew. Now, the interesting thing is that Jerome himself admitted that he knew that that was not grammatically sound, that that did not follow the proper rules of Hebrew grammar. But the reason why Jerome did it was because as he read Ezekiel 38, he saw Magog, Meshech, Tubal, Gomer, Togarmah, and he recognized that a number of the nations mentioned in Ezekiel 38 were clearly the offspring of Japheth mentioned in Genesis chapter 10. So he could recognize Meshech. In fact, shall we just have a look at Genesis chapter 10, just in terms of the background there, because if you hold your hand in Ezekiel 38 and come back to Genesis chapter 10, this is what happened, you see. Jerome is translating he recognizes that the list of nations that he's translating the names for are essentially Japhethite descendants. And here they were in Genesis 10, verse 1. These are the generations of the sons of Noah, Shem, Ham, and Japheth, and unto them were born sons after the flood. The sons of Japheth, Gomer, well, he found that in Ezekiel 38. Magog, he found that in Ezekiel 38. Madai, which incidentally is the word Media elsewhere translated, it relates to the Medes and the Persians. Now, in fact, the word Media wouldn't be in Ezekiel 38, but the word Persia would be. Then Javan, which wasn't there, but Tubal was, and Meshech was. So Jerome recognized that these names all came essentially from Genesis chapter 10. But the reason why he decided to translate Rosh as an adjective, even though he knew it broke grammatical rules, was because he couldn't identify Rosh as either a name or a people. So he rejected it as a proper name. And he followed Aquila and decided to translate it as chief in its common form, as it's used in many, many other places in the biblical record in an adjectival sense. But I think the critical thing to notice here is Jerome himself admitted that this was not conforming to the rules of Hebrew grammar. He was driven by his own imperative, which seemed reasonable enough at the time. I can't identify this as a name or a nation, so I'm going to reject it in its name form. Did you have a question?
No.
So at least there was a method to why he did that. Now, the interesting thing about that is that that one single decision of Jerome led to the Latin Vulgate expunging the name Rosh. And that one decision which entered the Vulgate influenced all the other translations that followed afterwards, including the Authorized Version. The Authorized Version took its approach directly from the Latin Vulgate on this matter. So the Latin Vulgate has ended up with the chief prince of Meshech and Tubal. That's exactly what the AV did. But if you come to scholarship today, you'll find that it's certainly divided because the King James Version reads Rosh as an adjective and translates it as chief. So does the Revised Standard Version. So does the New International Version. But in more recent times, biblical scholarship has said, actually, we think that was wrong. Not only is the Authorized Version wrong, but Jerome was wrong, and that it should be read as a proper name. And the New King James Version reads it as Rosh. The Jerusalem Bible reads it as Rosh. New English Bible reads it as Rosh. The American Standard Version and the New American Standard Bible all translate it Rosh as a proper name. So there's difference even within our translations. There's a divergence of opinion. But the more recent translations have hewed to the line more consistently of treating it as a proper name. So what I'm going to do is walk through for you what I think are the principal arguments that are raised against the idea of Rosh being taken as a proper name and what the rebuttal for those arguments are. And there are essentially two critical areas of argument. There are grammatical arguments and philological arguments. So let me just work through both of those and they'll make sense as we travel. So the first thing is the grammatical argument. Should Rosh be taken as a proper name or not? Well, one of the arguments that's been raised is because of the listing of the names given in Ezekiel 38 and verse 2, that the absence of a conjunction between Rosh and Meshech precludes Rosh from being taken as a noun in the series. Which, if I can just translate that, what it means is there's a missing and. So what they're saying is that to read properly, they believe it should read, Gog of the land of the Magog, the prince of Rosh and Meshech and Tubal. There should be an and there between each of those nations in the series of nouns of proper names. Rosh, proper name, and Meshech, proper name, and Tubal. And because that first and is missing, they're saying, well, that affects how Rosh ought to be used. It shouldn't be taken as a proper name, and therefore it should be taken as an adjective. Now, in fact, yes?
Briefly, does Hebrew not have commas? Is that typical construction in Hebrew? Because it's not typical construction in English. Are they talking only about
It's Hebrew form. Yep, it's Hebrew standard Hebrew grammar.
That you would typically have an and.
You would have an and. Exactly. Except, it's true, by the way, that is a grammatical rule in the Hebrew. Except, there just happens to be exceptions. So here's a couple of exceptions. In fact, I'm going to give you three exceptions. The first one, if you come back to Isaiah 66, and you end up with enough exceptions that you say, well, the rule's no rule. So the first one is in Isaiah 66. And in verse 19 of Isaiah 66, it says, and this is exactly how the Hebrew's written, I will set a sign among them, and I will send those that escape of them unto the nations to Tarshish, Pul, and Lud. Now, do you notice there's no conjunction between Tarshish and Pul? It's a series of three names, but it's actually Tarshish, no conjunction, Pul, and Lud. And yet that's the very argument that's been used as to why Rosh ought not to be translated. Rosh is a proper name in Ezekiel 38, but we translate Tarshish as a proper name. Tarshish means something else, but we didn't translate it adjectivally here. We translated it as a proper name, even though there was no conjunction between the first and second proper names. Here's another example, even more relevant, because it's in the prophecy of Ezekiel. In Ezekiel chapter 27, we're told this, in Ezekiel 27 and verse 13. Ezekiel 27 verse 13 says, Javan, Tubal, and Meshech, they were thy merchants. So notice that we've got another list of three proper names, but there's no conjunction between the first and the second. But we don't take Javan in some other form, we treat it as a proper name. We've got Javan, no conjunction, Tubal, then a conjunction, and Meshech. But we translate all three names as proper names. So in other words, what we're saying is the supposed rule gets broken by the prophets themselves. And you want to notice, do you want to see the clincher? The clincher is, come back to Ezekiel 38. So remember what the argument was? The argument was that because there wasn't a conjunction, the word and, between Rosh and Meshech, even though there is one between Meshech and Tubal, that Rosh ought not to be given credence as a proper name because the conjunction's absent. Well, read verse 5 of Ezekiel 38. Persia, Ethiopia, and Libya. No conjunction between the first and second proper names. Now the word pras, which is the word for Persia, also has some other meaning translated in its adjectival form. But it wasn't translated as an adjective, it's translated as a proper name, but there's absolutely no conjunction between the first and second names in a list of yet another three nations. So the rule's broken, not only in other places, but in fact, right here in Ezekiel 38, verse 5, there's another list of three nations, and yet there's no conjunction between the first and the second. So what we're saying is, that argument is specious. There's no validity to that argument. In fact, not only is there no validity to that argument, in fact, it's the very reverse. That when you look at the grammar of Ezekiel 38 and verse 2, the word Rosh appears in what's described as the construct form. And it means that the grammar forms naturally and properly a list of three nouns. In other words, if the word Rosh was missing, if we took the word Rosh out of Ezekiel 38 verse 2, how it would read grammatically is Gog of the land of the Magog, the prince of Meshech and Tubal. There's just no doubt that that's how it would read grammatically. So the only question is, what's the value of the word Rosh if we add it in? And the answer is, it's in the construct form which says it should be read as a series of three nouns. That's the Hebrew rules of grammar. Now, that was those very rules of grammar that Jerome recognized he was not observing when he translated it as chief in the Latin Vulgate. His only reason for doing so was because he couldn't identify the nation. So, in fact, it is grammatically correct to accept Rosh as a proper noun. I don't know if anyone's heard of Jesenius. I dare say most of you have. Jesenius would be regarded as probably one of the all-time greatest Hebrew scholars, Jesenius says that is the grammatically correct translation of Ezekiel 38, verse 2. Rosh must be translated, undoubtedly, as a proper name, he says, in terms of Hebrew grammar. Just one last thing about the grammar then, and that's this, that the simple grammar of the phrase Norsi Rosh, which is the word Prince of Rosh, Norsi Rosh, that simple grammar favours Rosh as a noun. Because if it was going to be adjectival, it should read Norsi Ha Rosh, which would then allow it to be translated as Prince the Chief, which when we express it in English is the Chief Prince. So if it was going to be read, going to be translated as the Chief Prince, it should be Nisi Ha Rosh, but it's not Nisi Ha Rosh in the Hebrew, it's simply Nisi Rosh or Norsi Rosh. So the grammar does not allow to translate it as chief if you're going to follow the Hebrew properly. So from a grammatical point of view, from the line of the grammatical argument, I think there's absolutely no doubt whatsoever that Rosh ought to be translated as a proper name. Now that comes to the philological argument. You don't know what philology is? What does it sound like? It sounds like philosophy. It's to do with the not so much the grammar now as the linguistics and the naming, the issue of the name itself. So the question of the name, which was Jerome's problem, you see. So here's the philological argument. It's been argued that because Rosh was unknown as a nation, that it oughtn't to be translated as a noun, it should be left as an adjective. But if you come to Ezekiel 27, verse 23, what we're told in Ezekiel 27, verse 23 is it says, Haran and Cana and Eden, the merchants of Sheba, Asher and Kilmad were thy merchants. No one's got a clue where Kilmad was. No one has any idea what nation Kilmad was, where it was territorially. No identification whatsoever. But it was translated as the name of a nation all the same, even though no one had any idea where it was or what it was. Likewise, when you come to Ezekiel chapter 30 and verse 5, and notice incidentally both of these references are in the prophet Ezekiel. In Ezekiel 30 verse 5 it says, Ethiopia, yep, we know that, Libya, yes, Lydia, yes, and all the mingled people, and Chub. Chub? Where's Chub? No one's got a clue where Chub is. No one's got a clue who Chub was. But it was still translated as a proper name, even though there was no basis of identifying as a nation. Yes.
By the way, mingled people is Arab people.
Yeah, I wouldn't translate it that way, though. I wouldn't say mingled people as Arab people. I'd say the word for mingled people is the Hebrew word Arab, which doesn't necessarily mean Arab people. You see what I'm saying? The word Arab itself means mingled in the Hebrew, but they could have used that of the Scythians. So it's not that it's Arab people, but that the word in the Hebrew is Arab, which means mingled. I agree with that. Whether it's actual Arabs is another matter altogether. So the context would determine whether it was mingled Arab people or mingled other people. So in this case, what we've got are two nations, both of which are completely unknown, and yet the names were translated just as they should be. So to argue that we can't translate Rosh as a name of a nation because we don't know who it is or where it is doesn't hold water, because in the prophecy of Ezekiel we've already got two other unknown nations that are named as proper names. But in fact, here's the interesting thing, is that Rosh was known. And it was known in the Bible. And it was known in the book of Genesis. Because had Jerome read a little further, if you come to the book of Genesis, and let me get the right place here, Genesis chapter 46. In the book of Genesis chapter 46 and verse 21... It says, And the sons of Benjamin were Bela and Beker and Ashbel and Gera and Naaman and Ehi and Rosh. Proper name. Right in the first book of the Bible. Same Hebrew word. So Rosh already was a proper name. Now, admittedly, this is the proper name of a person, not a nation. And incidentally, I don't think that this person, one of the sons of Benjamin, is the Rosh of Ezekiel 38. But that's not the issue. The issue is that it was unknown as a name or a nation. The answer is, well, it was. It was already known in the book of Ezekiel, the book of Genesis, right at the start of the Bible. And not only that, but when we come to the Septuagint, what we'll find is that Septuagint used the word Rosh on three separate occasions. It not only translates the word Rosh as a proper name in Ezekiel 38, but it translates it in Jeremiah 25, verse 23, and Isaiah 66, verse 19. Now, we're not going to go to those two passages. You might like to take a note of them. But in both cases, they translated, the Septuagint translated another word as Rosh, which doesn't appear in the English version. And that's to do with a textual difference in the passages. But the point that we're making is, why did the Septuagint, on three separate occasions in translating the Bible, why did they use the word Rosh at all? And the answer is because it was known. And because it was known as a nation, because there was a nation known in ancient history as Rosh. And here's the really interesting bit. In Assyrian and Ugaritic documents, there are over 20 references to Rosh, which all occur pre-Ezekiel. Pre-Ezekiel. So when Ezekiel mentions Rosh, that nation was an identity and a proper name before Ezekiel prophesies. So to argue that, well, it can't be taken philologically as a name because no one knew who it was, is just absolutely untrue. And would you like to see the clincher for this one? Well, I think the clincher is that if you come back to Genesis, you need to know a little bit about language and how language works, you see. But, and by the way, I don't, so I'm not pretending to be an expert in language. But if you come back to Genesis chapter 10 and to the sons of Japheth, because Jerome was absolutely right, this was a Japhethite confederacy. He was right on that, wasn't he? Ezekiel 38 is a Japhethite confederacy. He correctly identified that most of the names of the primary combatants come from the sons of Japheth in Genesis chapter 10. But what perhaps Jerome didn't realize was that Rosh was hiding there all along. And it's hiding here when it says in Genesis 10, verse 2, the sons of Japheth, Gomer and Magog and Madai and Javan and Tubal and Meshech and Terosh. And the word Rosh is, we believe, embedded in the Teras of Genesis 10, verse 2, the last son of Japheth. And we believe that that Rosh is the very basis of the Rosh who's going to emerge in Ezekiel chapter 38. It was there all along. It's one of the sons of Japheth. Now, what we're going to do in our mapping expedition pretty well now is, in fact, we're going to do just this. We're going to investigate the word Rosh and the word Magog and the word Tubal and Meshech. We're going to trace those nations in terms of information to see if we can plot them on a map, and we'll discover that that word Teras is extremely interesting because it's got undoubted connections to the people whose name was the Ross. It's connected to this word Teras in Genesis chapter 10, so I think it was there all along. So quite interesting, really. So what we're going to do now is to put ourselves on hold whilst we launch into our investigations. And bearing in mind that what we're going to do is to, I think, try and track down these nations where they first emerge, and I've got maps to help you with this, and then we're going to see where they migrated later on as to how it might emerge at the time of the end.